The Institute for Communication and Religion at Seton Hall University provides a nexus for ongoing scholarly exploration of communication topics critically important to religion and society. One especially critical juncture is the role of religion in our democratic process. To study the intersection of religion and politics, in 2020, the Institute hosted a series of expert presentations addressing religious issues in the historic Trump-Biden presidential race. We are proud to present these presentations here in podcast format, and we are grateful to the Lilly Fellows Program for their generous funding of this initiative.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Institute for Communication and Religion's conference on the intersection of faith, politics, and rhetoric in the 2020 U.S. presidential election. My name is John Radwin, and I'm honored to serve as ICR Director and your host today. Sponsored by the Lilly Fellows Program, Seton Hall University is proud to present Communication and Religion in the 2020 U.S. presidential election, bringing together some of the foremost scholars in their fields to discuss and share their expertise with students, faculty, and the general public. Broadcast live to registrants across the country, the event will also be simulcast by Shemaru, a leading media and distribution company based in India. The views expressed at this conference are those of the participants. The university, Qua University, neither endorses nor opposes any candidate or political party, but in the grand tradition of academic inquiry and freedom, brings you this conference, its scholars, and their views on what many have referred to as a critical juncture in both U.S. and world history. I am now happy to introduce today's first conference speaker, Dr. Ronald C. Arnett. He serves as chair of the Department of Communication and Rhetorical Studies, the Patricia Daugherty Yoder and Ronald Wolf Endowed Chair in Communication Ethics at Duquesne University, and the Henry Corin CSP Endowed Chair for Scholarly Excellence. He is the author or co-author of 11 books and co-editor of 6 books. The recipient of 8 book awards, he was named Distinguished Scholar by the National Communication Association in 2017. Arnett is currently serving his third editorship for the Journal of Communication and Religion and is the former editor of the Review of Communication. He is the executive director of the Pennsylvania Communication Association and former executive director of the Eastern Communication Association. Dr. Arnett will be speaking with us today on Practices That Matter, the Faith and Politics of Dorothy Day, for about 1 hour, and will be followed by about 15 minutes of Q&A with the audience. Please ask your questions via the chat feed. And by the end of today's event, please be sure to fill out the feedback form also shared via the Q&A chat feed. I now give you Dr. Ronald C. Arnett.
Thank you, John. It's an honor to be here. And thanks to everyone who's made this possible, including your technological crew who's done such a wonderful job. Thank you, Burke, and for all the work you've done. When I was asked to do this, John knew that I'm working, my current book project is on Dorothy Day. And this is a framing of Dorothy Day that I'm going to be sharing with you. And one of my ongoing concerns in this historical moment is that we are losing sight of the practices that matter. We are critical of others and not as attentive to the practices that we can engage in and can control. Dorothy Day is a wonderful exemplar of someone who was both critical and simultaneously incredibly supportive of the church. And she offers us an exemplar of practices that matter. I want to frame this in terms of how practices work. Practices are central to Catholicism in terms of practices, story, together generate an ongoing narrative of the faith. When someone is in trouble, it is seldom that we tell them, golly, I have this story that I would like to share with you. And that story will somehow move people to health. Generally, what we do is we try to alter human lives by altering their practices. when students come to me and they say, can I change who I am? To a degree, the answer is always yes. Change your practices and you can change your identity formation. Dorothy Day was a genius at understanding the power of practices within the faith and the way in which that drives identity and action. There have been Dorothy Day since her death in November of 29, 1980. There have been thousands of books and articles written about her. She's the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. She's inspirational in terms of the life that she lived. Perhaps the most impressive thing for me about Dorothy Day is the troubled life that leads up to a life of great productivity and the glorious reception of many in the Catholic Church to her. There is a sense of grace that one finds in the renewal of practices. And I just got done talking to John's class. And I said, perhaps the primary key of human life is not what we do, but how we respond to moments that are problematic and the moments that go wrong. And Dorothy Day is a prime example of a human being responding with incredible grace, responsively to a life as she searched her way through the element of her own sense of existential loneliness. I want to pause for a moment and talk about the element of that existential loneliness of Dorothy Day. Augustine has been termed as the first existentialist, in which he says, or asks this question, I am a question unto myself, as he is engaging existence and trying to find his way. Dorothy Day makes a similar move. In terms of having that engagement with existence and wanting to find her way. I am a question unto myself. But I think Dorothy Day adds another dimension that is incredibly helpful to us today. I'm not sure she asked solely stating, I am a question unto myself. She asked the question about we are questions unto ourselves. This historical moment is a moment in which we've lost sight in many dimensions of existence, of the importance of community. Throughout Dorothy Day's life, community is central, and she reminds us that the pronoun we is quite important. I was listening to someone who was saying, I need to take care of number one. And for most of us, when we hear that phrase, I take care of number one, it's taking care of the practice of the individual self. For Dorothy Day, taking care of number one was community, the local community, the way in which one can make a difference in the lives of the poor and the needy. As she developed the Catholic Worker Movement with Peter Morin, it is impressive that she does so with a commitment to community, to the practice of engaging the poor and being concerned about others. And constantly, the two of them looked at the necessity and importance of providing a philosophical orientation for the Catholic Worker Movement. It would be a mistake to understand the Catholic Worker Movement is simply a practice of going out and assisting people. The amount of time for prayer, the amount of time for study, the amount of time for spiritual enrichment is built into the movement, in which there's a sustaining why. I love the work of Alistair MacIntyre, who is the premier Catholic ethicist, and he talks about three generations of people who can engage and make an impact on the world. The first generation knows the how and the why. The second generation, they know the how and the why, but they get so tired of all those stories about the why. They just want people to go out and just do it, get it done. We've got so many things to do. So the second generation engages in what they think is a gift to the third generation. That gift is telling people how to do things, omitting the why. Right now, in my judgment, we're suffering from too many people being part of the second generation. The notion of the integration of how and why is crucial. And the Catholic worker movement is an exemplar of the importance of the integration of the two. If one is in agreement or disagreement with Dorothy Day, one cannot ignore the power of knowing why you are doing something and having a practical impact. Think of the exhaustion level that most of us have at a certain stage, either with children, with relatives, with your job, or with your country. The fatigue level seems high. The practices are incredibly important, and the why for those practices essential. What sustains us at times is not success, but for the recognition that this is the right thing to do, and I know why it is the right thing to do. Dorothy Day, in her search for a way to stabilize her life, seems similar to many of us trying to stabilize ours. One student after another, one colleague after another, in this pandemic, and wondering what has been lost and can we find things that have been gained. But the word lost has been uttered to me more often than any other time in my academic career. The openness of what the gift of being lost is, that it allows one to think of the necessity of change. Both Augustine and Dorothy Day point to a derivative self. The derivative self is called by the events before you. We can't muscle our way through a pandemic. We can't muscle our way through the politics of this moment, locally, nationally, or internationally. A derivative self is called by the moment. It's like in a family, you have things are just not going well. Someone is sick. Someone else has lost a job. There is sadness. And all of a sudden, somebody in the family that you never expected to step up and assist does. And they lead and they help and they heal. And it's not that the person is functioning like an originative self, some kind of Western hero, but a derivative self attending to the following: if not me, then whom? Such moments existentially call us into action. They reshape our identity. They reshape who we are. And for Dorothy Day, one of the elements of that reshaping is the notion of a common center of a community. That common center for her is a unity of contraries. It's got the practical and it has the spiritual dimension that is both are acted upon each day. But there's a common center that reminds people each day why people are part of a community. Communities are not held together by my goodness or your goodness or that of another. They're held together by something much more sacred than you and me. They're held together by sacred ground, something worth working with people you do not like. Common centers are bigger than how my liking, your liking, something that needs to be nurtured and built and guided. Martin Buber was the individual who first introduced me to the notion of common center, and in his book on Pathways to Utopia does this major critique of a psychological understanding of community. The common center, in terms of the ground of religious responsibility, is a narrative. Think about how you shape people today. Often we talk about the individual communicative agent, in which we think about one person impacting another. But there are other ways to think about how identity is shaped. The faith shapes identity with the ground under our feet. Under our feet, we have a narrative structure that reminds us about virtues that are important, ways to treat someone, how to guide people, and how to act. One of the elements of a narrative that I find so interesting, the issue of practices and story coming together and then people having some element of collective belief in those practices and story, is the reclaiming of the notion of guilt. Guilt is, in my judgment, one of the most important communicative elements. And Dorothy Day understood the power of guilt. What guilt does is that when the practice is problematic and weaves far away from a given narrative direction, guilt reminds one of a necessity of moving back to the importance of that narrative. We find a way to guide a human life connected to something bigger than you and bigger than me. Dorothy Day understood that community is a craft. We build communities together. We build them with a common center. We build them with ground under our feet. And there's something very interesting about community. When things go wrong and an individual makes a mistake, that's kind of a moment for a little moment of celebration. Because when somebody admits something has gone wrong, others in the community can step up and help to fix it. Think about what happens when you can't admit an infraction or something that is wrong. You hide it. And you lie in order to protect the individual self. The irony is that community needs and requires people making mistakes and confessing them so others can assist in constructing what one alone cannot put together in a constructive way. The craft of community begins with confession. A religious communication ethic is how I think a religious narrative ethic comes from a variety of different authors in the field of communication. One of them being Barnett Pierce, another Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and another, Jacques Ellul. Barnett Pierce is connected to the discipline of communication. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, of course, struggled and gave his life in the argument against Adolf Hitler. And Jacques Ellul, in his thoughtful critique of the West, we do things because they can be done, not because they should be done. to develop a religious communication narrative ethic, first from Pierce, we need to recognize there are multiple moral positions out there. There's continual argument about what direction, what common center ought to drive our action. I think the difficult key is to try to find a common center, to commit a life to it, to commit a life to an ongoing narrative, which Dorothy Day clearly did, and fight the impulse of self-righteousness, which another author has referred to as the most problematic stance that a human being can take. Dietrich Bonhoeffer brought to us the importance of narrative ground, saying that perhaps the most vicious thing we can do to and for another human being is to take the ground from under their feet. Recognizing there are multiple moral positions does not mean that one is a relativist. It just means you need to take responsibility for the position that you hold, and simultaneously be careful that you don't do it in such a self-righteous way that your good turns on itself into a banality of evil. Jacques Ellul, in a phrase that I've already quoted, how could one, the notion of doing what can be done rather than what should be done, that is the ground that nurtures a banality of evil. We've all been in positions where it is possible to do something without any kind of ongoing question. There are two of those that I've alluded to already. Individualism that Dorothy Day attempted to counter is assumed often within the West as the primary way to function. Our heroes are people often disassociated from communities. Individualism does not counter the importance of the individual. To critique individualism does not counter it. The individual is important, but as individuals are situated within communities, they become persons. And when we ignore communities, we move into the realm of individualism, which stands above human history, not attending to family, not attending to faith commitments, not attending to local commitments, not attending to our international obligations. Individualism, in my judgment, is the banality of evil of this historical moment. Trying to find a way in which we can reclaim our commitment to one another, not because we like one another, but because the common center is trying to preserve an earth, trying to preserve interaction for all people, trying to somehow, in the words of Dorothy Day, find a way out of loneliness, propelled by self-preoccupation. Building a community frames the craft of building a community. There are many people who have talked about the means as the ends and the making, but the way in which that works is that our practices matter. It is very difficult to do, quote, good, saying the only thing that matters is the outcome. Much of the events that happen in our lives, we can't really control the outcome. If you're a parent, you really can't control the outcome. If you're a teacher, you can't control the outcome. We can't control the outcome of whether or not our political candidate will win or not. That doesn't mean that we can't engage in practices that try to bring forth the kind of world that we think is needed and necessary. But the way in which we do it matters as much as what we do. I talked earlier about the importance of community, but the means and the ends are essential in community, or otherwise we unleash self-righteousness and we unleash a kind of deceit toward one another. The book by Richard Adams on Watership Down is actually one of my favorite books to talk about what Stanley Hauerwas has referred to as a community of character. Hauerwas, a well-known ethics professor in theology, would frequently describe Richard Adams' novel, Watership Down, about these rabbits. Here's this well-known and well-published author talking about rabbits and a warren. But the rabbits lose their place, their home, constructions coming in, and they're lost. And they have to find a new home in the midst of being lost. And note, I'm emphasizing that one more time. In the midst of being lost, they search for ground under their feet. But it's not ground simply of place. Their place has been disturbed. Their place has been lost. But they begin to look for ground under their feet that is closer to what would be termed space. Narrative moral ground. And they begin to tell these stories that they had not told to one another for years, that bring a light to the way in which they can act, the way in which they can work with one another, and they gradually begin to find their way. McIntyre refers to Christianity as a philosophy of mobility, that we're able to carry the faith on our backs with us when we move forward. Narrative ground goes with you. If you're a parent, you want to help your daughter or your son find narrative ground no matter where they are, no matter what the conditions. There's ground under their feet. They can be thousands of miles away from you, and they feel at home. Home is not simply a place. It is a space. I often use the example of the difference between a house and a home. A house is a construction, but a home, it's given life by the people in it that are part of it, the stories, the practices, the engagements of people. Hauerwas gives us this wonderful example of a children's story that has incredible implications for adults. The means are the ends in the making. We cannot control the ends. We can control the means. And one of the means is narrative ground under our feet. If you have ever met someone who is so intent on one outcome, just one, it has to be that outcome. I got a hunch that even if the person wins, the person still loses something. There is this incredible anxiety about the outcome, but outcomes slip between our fingers. Outcomes are more like sand between our fingers. They slip. As one person has stated, perhaps the most accurate understanding of truth is putting your hands together and putting sand in it, and it slips out. We cannot solidify it. We cannot grasp it. We can't turn it into concrete without killing it. Narratives under our feet need to be nourished constantly by reflective practices. We nourish our narratives. We don't just live off of them. As the rabbits of the Watership Down Warren found their way, they found it through reflective practices, and they did it when they were lost, a student came into my office and was in incredible distress about the time, this moment in which we live, for a whole host of reasons. As I'm communicating with the student by Zoom, I wanted to pause with the student and celebrate one word: lost. One of the dangers of one of the gifts of being lost is that you need to find something. And when one lives a life without feeling lost, you don't have to find much. You can just complain when life is not moving in your direction. What propelled Dorothy Day is that she felt lost and lonely, and the faith and reflective practices within community began to nurture the way in which she could reconstitute and frame a life together. The Catholic worker movement was a community of practical and faith-centered projects. If I could wave a magic wand about this moment, it would be to say to people, wow, many of us are lost. What a wonderful time to find our way, to rediscover the importance of family, to rediscover the importance of connection to others, to rediscover our commitment and our practical necessity for being concerned about the poor, to be thankful for what's before us, and to begin to recognize that even in careers, one can have a vocation. Dorothy Day, clearly in her work, it's propelled by vocation, not by career. Most of us have careers and do not feel called in the same way that Dorothy Day was. But the way in which we can rub shoulders with her is around the issue of vocation. If a vocation calls forth action that is greater than career, and each person in a long-term career can think of moments in which you have been tempted to sacrifice being concerned about others to advance your own career. They're not opposites, but they are held in tension. A career calls us to individual success, and vocations call us to the fact that the means of getting there matters more than where we arrive. Dorothy Day, through a long life, reminds us of the importance of vocation and the importance of engaging in labor that is means-centric, for the means matter. A vocation is defined by what I described as a derivative self. And again, McIntyre is central in trying to talk about the three generations. But a derivative self is called forth into action. Think about being a young family and you have your first child and you're looking at the child and you're somehow thinking that your life has changed and you will never be the same again. And the answer to that is correct. You will not. A vocation, when you assume it, you are never the same again. One can have a vocation for others out of a religious commitment, but not everybody is called to be a priest or a nun or a brother, but all of us are called, if we listen, to attend to vocations within given careers that require an element of sacrifice. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was good in describing his he was considered the primary community theologian of the 20th century. And as he differentiated the issue between cheap grace and costly grace, costly grace simply means it costs us something. Vocations are not cheap they cost us something. And as you think about the world in which we live, in terms of there's a cost when communities are forgotten, but there's also a cost to us when we are the ones helping in the forgetting. Costly grace has us in a position as a derivative self, willing to give of ourselves in such a way that empirically our careers perhaps will not move as far as we would want them to do so. Most of us, including me, do not want to engage in the sacrifice of a Dorothy Day, but the call of a vocation and glimpses of that vocation that I can learn from, and so can all of us. She points to an understanding of community that is based on an element of craft. What's it mean to be a craftsman? Aristotle talks about that phrase, and I'm from a construction family, and I've always liked the metaphor of craft. And you think about the expert who knows how to do something really well, but it's the craftsman who not only knows how to do something, but loves it and is willing to sacrifice for it. Dorothy Day was a craftsman of community, and we need more craftsmen of community who understand the importance of vocation, the importance of the means, the importance of working in such a way that we are not simply intent on the conclusion. We're intent on the way of the way in which we are attempting to get to that conclusion. I talk about Dorothy Day's commitment to vocation also through the lens of Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl's work gives us three ways to find meaning: through what we give to life, from what we get from life, and the stand against the inevitable. Vocations are based on what we give. They're also based on our responses to what we get. And finally, they're situated in our stand against the inevitable. That deep loneliness that propelled Dorothy Day. One has a deep loneliness when one only is asking to get things. Think about the issue of giving and getting and the stand against the inevitable. Two-thirds of that we can actually impact. What we give, we can impact. Our stand against the inevitable, we can impact. We can't always control what we get. Vocations concentrate on giving and the stand against the inevitable, meaning our responses to moments that we do not appreciate nor want. I have critiqued modernity, which Dorothy Day repeatedly has done, through a book on Arendt, in which modernity has a great deal of fascination with effectiveness of efficiency, individual autonomy, and the notion of progress. I'm always skeptical when I hear someone wanting to talk about progress as if somehow the new is better than the old. Sometimes it is, sometimes it's not. You can imagine prior to the year 2008, General Motors asking people, what kind of car would you want? And people are asking repeatedly for vehicles closer to large V8 engines. And the market for such cars was long past, and General Motors went bankrupt. Only the federal government assists. What would have happened if one was working from a vocational standpoint and they asked this question, what does the world need in terms of sustainability? Not just what someone wants. Often when we ask somebody, what do you want? We're already getting information that is dated. It is information of the herd. It's to use these two names together is funny, but I think Dorothy Day would have liked the way in which Steve Jobs was innovative. He did not ask people what they wanted. He built products that people did want. Dorothy Day did not take a poll each time she moved in the direction of hospitality houses, concern for issues of peace, intervention in places of poverty. There clearly was disagreement with many of her decisions. And if she'd taken a poll, she would have followed a given direction, followed the herd. And at this point today, we wouldn't be talking about Dorothy Day. We'd be talking about someone else. Vocations require a kind of creativeness that do not always follow the crowd. You need to be attentive to what the crowd is doing, and you need to know why you don't want to do it. I want to go back to Arendt. She does this massive critique of Americans wanting to belong. She says, why don't they ask, do I want to belong to that group? Not all communities are equal. Not all communities do you want to be a part of. And the job of an adult is to try to figure out which ones you're going to join and to recognize there's going to be criticism in whatever choice that you engage. I want to talk about community in one more way. I want to call it the absurd of our historical moment. Albert Camus, so well known for using the notion of the absurd, personifies the ongoing challenge of Dorothy Day's life, like Sisyphus, pushing this huge boulder up, being exhausted at the end of the day, sleeping, getting up, and doing it again, over and over and over. To make a difference in this world today, I don't think I would want to privilege the word progress. I think I'd want to privilege the word absurd, because I think the sacred and the importance of community is tied more fundamentally to the absurd. There's no guarantee that community will help. There's no guarantee that the kinds of issues that require attentiveness. All the work of Dorothy Day on peace and look at the world today. All the work on poverty and look at the world today. She is not an exemplar of an end. She is an exemplar of a means. What's it mean to live life in the absurd, to embrace community when all around it seems as if there is no reason to do so? The notion of existential homelessness was a term I penned quite a while ago. Its vibrancy continues to propel me. What's it mean to feel like you don't belong? And what's it feel like to keep going, even though you don't? You can imagine Dorothy Day meeting with someone who feels homeless existentially and often empirically. She gives them a temporal home. She's critiqued for giving people support who, in the words of many, did not deserve it. And her comment is, we give support to all. We do not ask whether they are worthy. It is the task of all of us. If I could find a way of describing Dorothy Day in a way that would personify the necessity of this historical moment, if she were here and she was asked, who should I vote for? I'd love to hear her answer. I think she might vote for community. I think she might vote for practices that move in the direction of peace. I think she might vote for being able to work with people you do not like. I think she would work and vote out of a sense of conviction that this historical moment is another time in which the human community is in trouble. We've embraced a moral cul-de-sac, and that moral cul-de-sac is individualism, of being more concerned about my participation in the world than our participation in the world. The movement of the absurd is to reclaim the question, how big is my family? And boy, it is big in the eyes of Dorothy Day. Our families go well beyond the scope of our blood relatives, our neighbors, our country. Perhaps she would be talking about communal citizens. And I end with one final statement. Justice Day was concerned about the issue of community. She recognized that no religious community is a place of perfection. It is indeed a gathering of the flawed and of the wounded, with each one of us with a call to support and help one another. That's why common centers are essential. We cannot be held together by one another alone. A faith-filled community finds meaning in toil, that cares for the afflicted and the poor, is inclusive of the stranger, the friend, and family. She's an archetype of the sacred calling of work, an expansive importance of the Catholic workers' movement, both practically and metaphorically. The task of Dorothy Day's project is to frame the coordinates, answering a basic existential question about why the work matters. And the work matters because the means matter. Day is the co-founder of the Catholic Workers Movement, united the empirical and the phenomenological significance of work. Through practices and the doing of labor, identity emerges because of the labor we do together. Finding meaning that comes from what one does associates that meaning with the activity. The faith-centered inspiration of Day is that the practices have an absurd sense of power. They are the place of miracles, dare I say, when we are in a moment in which many of us are lost. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Arnett. We're now moving into the Q&A portion of our session. We've got about 17 minutes left for questions, and there's already one coming in. I would encourage everybody else to send them in. The way we'll do this is I will read the question aloud, and Dr. Arnett will respond. Then I'll publish it in the Q&A feed so everybody else can read it as well. And so I encourage you all to ask questions. Our first question comes from Cynthia. Cynthia asks a poignant question. I have a recent college grad who is lost. Finding work and a future right now is very discouraging. Similarly, she does not want to come home. This makes me sad. I feel that the community of our small bubble of family community could provide support as she weighs her options. How can we help? I am struggling with tough love versus monetary support as she drifts aimlessly.
I feel for that dilemma you're articulating with probably a fairly large number of parents feel today. There is no easy answer. It's one thing to talk about community as an academic and talk about Dorothy Day. It's another to have your own child in the midst of a difficult moment, the difficulty of work and finding a given place. I think I'm so propelled by such questions of today. The book that I just finished, which is on the Scottish Enlightenment, differentiates between optimism and tenacious hope. If I could get rid of any word in our vocabulary, it would be optimism. It takes tenacious hope, incredible commitment of a parent. When all seems lost, you keep moving. And my comment to you is that all you can do is love the person that you are responsible for. And you keep trying and you keep trying and you keep trying. And the hope is that people find their way. And often people find their way through mistakes. And the job of parents is not to correct all mistakes. It is also to assist with supporting the responses of others as they are attempting to find their way. But this is really a time for parents to be really tenacious and not give up on the possibility of a child finding his or her way. There's no easy answer, but optimism will not get us there. It turns us into consumers and often into cynics, because when the world doesn't turn as we would want it to, we become bitter. Tenacious hope only wears us out. It doesn't make us cynical.
Thank you, Dr. Arnett. I'm not seeing another question in the chat feed, and that's perfectly fine because I've got lots of questions. I do encourage everybody else to use the feed. You closed on a theme of miracles. That's, I think, very fitting for Dorothy Day. Her book, Loaves and Fishes, describes how the movement itself is a miracle. They started in the Great Depression with nothing and managed to build an international movement that's still going today. The original plan for the movement came from her partner, Peter.
Yes.
And Peter's plan for the Great Depression was threefold, with a newspaper, so a communication effort, and then houses of hospitality, as you mentioned, and communitarian farms. And Dorothy says that she was convinced that that was the right plan for their time. And I guess my question to you is, we live in a different era. Certainly with journalism, newspapers have massively shifted. Do you have ideas about what a plan for our time, the 21st century, might be?
That's a really smart question, and I wish I had a smart answer. The first element is to reclaim the fact that practices matter. The second one is that the means matter. The third is the importance of community. How that unfolds, I think, needs to be tied to the local conditions of individual people. Do I think that there is some kind of large effort that could take place? I'm not sure. I think it's going to have to be on really a small scale, but at the very least, feeding the poor and feeding those whose lives are being disrupted during the pandemic is the first major step. From that, local communities might be able to find their way, but to impose an answer would seemingly make no sense. The answer came from people being attentive to the historical moment, of a Great Depression, eventually the of World War I, and of all the elements of disruption. Disruptions in the historical moment can bring forth creative responses. And who knows, there may be people a lot smarter than me and a lot more gifted who are going to begin to offer alternatives to the historical moment in which we are a part.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Arnett. Our next question comes from an anonymous poster. And, well, I'm not sure, but you can address the terminology. I think it's a little bit reversed. How can students and those in the upcoming generations practice tenacious hope actively during a time such as this?
If I were to give advice, which I fear giving, you have to find out the coordinates that are most important to you. And those coordinates begin to shape the kind of, you want to make sure that those coordinates are attended to in terms of a faith commitment, family commitment, friends, your commitment to doing the best work you possibly can. But the primary thing that you have to do is to think, if we were to look at an athlete who's a halfback and you're a coach and you're going, what kind of person do I really want to be a leader? You watch when that person's hit and whether or not the legs continue to move. Tenacious hope is based on the legs continuing to move after a person is hit. This is not a time for cheap grace. This is not a time for any of us to think that the world is simply going to turn quickly back in our direction. We need to encourage all students to have ground under their feet in such a way that they can continue to move in the midst of all this difficulty. And I think we would be lying to students to say this is an easy moment. This is a really demanding moment. And out of this, a great generation may come.
Thank you, Dr. Arnett. That's I think a really powerful piece of advice. Many of us in this audience are aware that Seton Hall has a Buccino Leadership Institute, and there's over 300 of us taking the class every Friday morning. Brian Price taught us just last week about crucible moments. And really, this era of American history and really world history is feeling like a crucible moment. And a great generation, I'm with you, can come out of it. I'm seeing that Natalia asks, are we responsible for giving coordinates to those who do not have them? Is that possible?
Well, that's a great question. I think the primary thing that we can do is point toward them, but we cannot give those coordinates. But we do need to point and try to be able to get someone has to own those coordinates or feel situated in them. But it's really essential to suggest, to point, to participate. But ultimately, we cannot give those coordinates to someone. We can only, it's like you can't give a sense of home to someone, but you can give a house to someone in which the possibility of a home can be constructed.
Okay, thank you. And then it's looking like our very last question is coming from Anthony. Professor Hainer asks, how would you complete the following? Focusing on the why without the how is blank. Focusing on the how without the why is blank.
I probably would not. I'd love to come up with a term that would be more memorable, but the best one I can come up with is insufficient. It's simply insufficient. The two are a unity of not of contraries, but a unity of companions that are essential. And every generation that begins to forget about the importance of why puts at risk a generation after it. And focusing only on the why without the practices is an invitation for becoming self-righteous.
Wonderful answer. I would not have thought of putting the same word in both blanks. So with that bit of wisdom, I think we're going to wrap up our session for today. Thank you from the Institute for Communication and Religion. Thank you to our tech team, especially Burke Loxley. Thank you to our GA, Asia Robinson. Thank you to Dr. Arnett and his team on his end. Thank you, Preston. And of course, thank you to the big team here at Seton Hall, SHU PR and Marketing with Lorraine Joyce. Thank you, Dr. Arnett.